In the new Lausanne Project podcast episode, our guest is Sarah Rinegar. Sarah and I are going to talk about her new book, Power and the Politics of Oil in the Soviet South Caucasus, Periphery Unbound, 1920 to 1929, which came out this year in January with Bloomsbury. Sarah, thank you so much for accepting our invitation.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, my first question to you is an obvious one. Why did you write this book, Sarah?
Yeah, I wrote this book in part to answer my own questions. So I think I got interested first in the history of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. And then when I started graduate school, I was more interested in the revolution, the 1920s and the non-Russian regions. And it was really only when I went to Baku to start working on language that I became more interested in oil and oil politics, and really just didn't have the answers to the questions that I had when I started to try to just figure out what was going on, and especially what was going on in the time period that I was looking at, which was that late 19th, early 20th century. Yeah, there is a lot about the imperial period, sort of up to World War I, but then it just kind of, the industry just sort of disappears in the literature almost up until the Second World War. So I was really just trying to figure out what happened in that time period. It sort of went from everything is destroyed to the industry has recovered, and I wanted to know what the story is there.
I say indeed, it's a very important region, South Caucasus, because as far as I know, in the first decade of the 1900s, at the turn of the 20th century, it was producing more than half of the world's crude oil. How did this happen? Why did it become, or how did it become such an important region? And who were the main actors there?
Baku was, produced over 90% of the Russian Empire's oil and oil products. And actually, even though it was the, I think it was over 50% of the world share in, I believe, 1903, somewhere around there, 1903, 1905, it was mainly a domestic market. It was mostly kerosene, but for purposes of the international market, what happened was basically that it was easy to produce. They built these railroads to get the oil products to market, and England was the main importer. So it was just importing tremendous amounts of Russian oil, but also the really Russian kerosene, but also the there were other markets as well. There were markets in Japan and in the Middle East, but definitely the largest trade partner was England.
And also, I guess the Noble Brothers, Royal Dutch Shell, they were all a Rothschild family. They all were involved in the, I guess, the oil boom.
The Nobel Brothers had the largest share and the most established company. And there was also, as you noted, the French Rothschilds. Royal Dutch Shell bought their shares, I think, in 1912, around there. So we had some real international actors who were developing these fields. There was a whole host of local producers as well, but the largest producers were foreign.
Yes, but then in the mid-1900s, with the Russian Revolution and the civil war between the Armenians and what we may now term the Azeris, the oil industry came to collapse. What happened to these main actors, and how did the South Caucasian oil industry and the Absheron Peninsula recover from this?
The industry was burnt to the ground. The wells were set on fire. A lot of the heavy industry was destroyed in 1905. But really, the decline of the industry has already in process. A lot of the machinery was old. There was new technology that wasn't being implemented in the fields. And what really happened was that these international actors, as I had just noted, that the Rothschild sold their shares to Royal Dutch Shell. And they did this because the industry was really viewed as unstable at that point, as unstable, that there was really the Russian government couldn't guarantee that this wouldn't happen again. It was looked at as a more risky investment. So a lot of that international money started to dry up. Although the Nobel brothers, it's an interesting story because I think that they were viewed more as a established local company, but that's kind of a different story. But really what happened was that there was a slow recovery, but really World War One is when they really started to develop the industry again. And I think that the other issue was that they were not just producing kerosene, they were producing more of the heavier oils, fuel oils for things like industry, for the railroads, for the ships. So that was a real boon to the industry again. So it had really recovered a lot, but by that point was much more of domestic.
But then in 1917, the Russian Revolution hit the entire empire. And in fact, the empire was no more. And it's actually where your study begins, right? In 1920s, you just train your eyes on what happened to the Absheron Peninsula, the politics of oil in the South Caucasus. So I think a fitting question here would be, why was the South Caucasian oil so vital for the Soviets?
This is a very good question. And this was a question that was actually challenging to answer because a lot of the literature I had read said that it was not important anymore because it was not a large share of international trade anymore and international production, which is true. But it was important for the Bolsheviks and for the Soviet state because it was one of the only sources of hard currency that they had available. And because they had largely been locked out of the international system, being able to have a commodity that they could leverage for hard currency and also for other reasons, which I can talk about a little bit later, it just became really important to restarting the economy. The initial strategy was military. I mean, they occupied Azerbaijan and then the rest of the South Caucasus. And I argue that one of the reasons that they wanted to occupy the rest of the South Caucasus was because they wanted control of these trade routes. They wanted the railroads that connected the Caspian and Black Seas so that they could get to the international market via Constantinople. So the initial part was, there were a couple of things. One was that they needed to restart production. That was step one. So the oil reserves were actually full. They had been sitting there, but oil production had stopped. So they needed to do two things. They needed to restart oil production and they needed to get the oil reserves that had built up out to Constantinople. So those were the two main things that they wanted to try to do. And once they did get control of the rest of the South Caucasus, Armenia and Georgia, they restarted shipments. And once they restarted shipments, they were also able to bring in resources from Constantinople. So they're bringing in workers. So they would ferry in large numbers of workers, thousands of workers to do the actual work in the fields, but also to bring in material. It was not initially very successful. The first year, especially 1920, 1921, they did a pretty dismal job. A lot of people didn't have food. They didn't have resources. The industry continued to collapse. It was really after that, when they started to be able to bring in more machinery. They were throwing resources at it. They were also using the Red Army to help guard the oil fields and to bring in forced labor to get people to really start producing again.
Right. So there is this economic investment and the bringing of workers was quite crucial for the recovery. But at the same time, in your book, you make this argument that Baku oil was more than a currency exchange for the Soviets. What do you mean by that?
They realized that people wanted access to their resources, or they knew that it was an attractive proposition if the oil industry recovered and that people were interested in it. So that both created an opportunity and a fear. So they were afraid of the British presence on the southern border. They were afraid that that meant that those oil fields were vulnerable to being seized. So in some sense, it was informing the security policy that they were starting to develop at the time. But they also knew that they could try to use this to get oil deals, to get concessions from governments. And they tried to leverage it in various different ways. I think the most important maybe for this podcast is that they realized by 1922 after the failure of the Genoa conference, that even though they weren't going to get diplomatic recognition, they could make deals with oil companies. And those oil companies would provide resources and would provide a market so that they could then get that hard currency. So it really became part of their, both their diplomatic approach, but also as a way to reestablish trade networks and establish themselves on the world stage.
But at the same time, I guess the region was quite important also in underpinning the empire, right? You say the story of Baku and oil in the 1920s was not a Russian and Azerbaijani story alone, but a Soviet story. Would you like to unpack that a bit?
Yeah, I think that the way that we think about these states today, they're you know, they're national states. They're states, Azerbaijan, obviously not just Azerbaijanis in Azerbaijan, but predominantly, and same for Georgia and Armenia. I realize that there are other populations there as well, but broadly speaking. But this really wasn't the case at the time. At the case, there's much more multinational, much more mixed up. And I think that there were lots of different people involved. I think there was a local conception as well of the Caucasus really being tied to Iran in a lot of ways, especially among the Azeri population, but not only. Also, the Georgian and Armenian populations had strong connections to Iran. And the local idea of Iran being part of the local culture sort of spilled over into politics, in that they really considered that that region should be part of the communist project and the socialist project. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect has to do with Moscow and its vision for a secure border and sort of cutting off these contacts in order to ensure the security of the state and the security of these oil fields really butted heads with that vision, that local vision that was much more fluid and not so bound to national borders.
Maybe if you could tell us a bit more on also the nature of the relationship between Baku and Moscow on the one hand, and the oil industrialists and the Bolshevik Party on the other hand in the 1920s. I'm very curious how decisions were made, political and economic decisions were made at the time. Are we speaking of a project, a Bolshevik project being imposed upon Baku and the oil industrialists? Or was it a more complex process, which I guess was the case, but how were decisions ultimately made?
Decisions were made in Moscow, but decisions couldn't be enforced. So you had to have a certain amount of, you had to have cooperation on the ground or coercion in various different degrees. And certainly in this early period, there was a lot of hope in the sort of the non-Russian, non-Moscow Bolsheviks, that they could have a large say in the way that the revolution and the Soviet state was going to be built. And so they were very invested in the project as well and had their own ideas about what they thought it should look like. And I think that's yet another thing that it didn't last terribly long past the early 1920s, because it became very clear that they had their own agendas. So this is something that I talk about. It reinforced for Moscow that they had their own agendas on the on this border area, and that they were really trying to centralize decision making and come up with different ways to enforce that decision making. And this had a corollary in the oil industry as well. So the oil industry was, it was nationalized. It was run by the Azerbaijan Oil Trust. And policy was developed in Moscow, but there was a tremendous amount of discretion about how to enact these policies. And there was not a lot of agreement between what Moscow wanted, which was this heavily centralized way of doing things, even early. I mean, I know this is not the sort of Stalinist economy that comes later, but it was still an economy where they wanted to dictate what was happening. And it just didn't really, it didn't really work. It didn't really work because on the ground they had different ideas about what should be happening. Moscow wanted to, and Lenin pretty in particular, wanted to bring in large-scale foreign concessions, sort of the feasibility of whether or not that was going to work, like whether the concessionaires themselves would ever come in is sort of a separate question. But on the ground, the both the geologists and a lot of the Bolsheviks, such as Orzhan Akidze, but also Serebrovsky, so people who have connections to Moscow and connections to Baku, really tried to thwart this policy, tried to undermine it by creating separate deals, trying to bring over technology and basically make the policy irrelevant, which is what ended up happening.
I think one of the strengths of your book is the fact that you're foregrounding the stories of four men who shaped Soviet policy in the South Caucasus at the time, such as Alexander Serebrovsky, Sergo Oryanikidze, and Leonid Kresin. And Nariman Narimanov, very crucial figure in Azerbaijani history. And I would like to ask a bit about him to you as we finalize our podcasts. Like, what role do you think he played, and he and other Azerbaijani figures played, in the building of the Soviet Union? And how do you think these so-called peripheral actors enable empire building? Or is it fair to say that he was a peripheral or regional actor?
I think that he played a big role. He certainly wasn't the only one. I focus on him in part because I find him so interesting, but he also, because he had these big roles. He is someone who was from an older generation, more of the Lenin generation, and had, yeah, he was a sort of jack of all trades. He was a medical doctor. He was a playwright, probably more known for his writing, I think, later on than for his politics, as a kind of a complicated history and legacy in Azerbaijan, because he did very actively facilitate the Red Army coming into Azerbaijan. That's because he was a Bolshevik. He was also part of the Baku Commune. I think that him, together with other people like Sergei Orzhanikidze, who is Georgian by nationality, but very involved in the Baku organization, Anastas Mikoyan, who was very young at the time, but he also plays a sort of a big role in integrating the Azerbaijan Communist Party into the wider Russian Communist Party, Soviet Communist Party. But Narimanov was so important because he spoke to the Muslim population, to the Azeri population, and also to the migrant Iranian population, and understood them as part of this bigger story. And he really saw sort of a liberatory, emancipatory vision in Bolshevism that he thought could overturn Russian imperial rule and really allow for a more robust local rule that would sort of lift people up, provide education, and really make sure that the Muslim population was benefiting from these massive proceeds that were coming in from the oil industry. So he had a vision. I think that his vision probably aligned more closely with what Lenin's vision would have for nationalities policy, not sort of a very theoretical on paper, obviously not what happened at the end of the day, but he was important. I hesitate to just say whether or not he was a local or peripheral actor, because I think all of these actors were important to establishing Soviet power. And he's also interesting because he saw very quickly that the promises were not the reality. And he was very frustrated by the use of violence that was ongoing in the early 1920s, realized fairly quickly that the oil proceeds of Baku were not just going to be coming back to the population, although he tried mightily to make sure that that would happen, set up an oil fund for the use of the Azerbaijan Republic. But also he had tried to keep the, he wanted the Trans-Caucasian Federation to be to have the head of that located in Baku. And when that it didn't happen and it went to Tbilisi, which was the sort of the pre-war capital of the region, he understood that his vision was not going to be happening, and that it was much more of a Russian sort of Soviet Moscow vision. Certainly, he had a paternalistic view of leadership. He thought that he should be in charge and that his vision was the right vision, especially when you come to questions like the Eastern Question. He felt like he needed to be in charge of that, that was certainly not the place of Moscow, that should be people from the region who are making those decisions. He both saw an opportunity to be in charge, but also really, he had worked for these causes for decades wanted change and thought that this was a way that it could happen. I think was very, very disappointed and bitter by the way that things ultimately turned out, which was with him being completely sidelined.
But this is a very interesting story, Sarah. And I sincerely thank you for making the time for us to talk about your really interesting book. And I really mean it. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. It's very rich. You use a very diverse set of sources. I appreciate the fact that you wrote that book as well.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.